works. Does anybody have a way of checking if the streaming is live? Go to forelesning, just to be sure. Live? Great. Okay. Today, as I mentioned in the announcement, we're going to have a two-part kind of lecture. First, we're going to go through the rest of the memory forensics part, and we'll focus on Linux memory forensics and some brief run-through of some Mac memory forensic tools. And then we're going to spend the rest of the time doing a lab. So hopefully it's about half and half of time to do this. But first we start with Linux memory forensics. And we're going to run through how to get the memory forensic, how to get the memory dumps. We're going to look at some of the internal structures. Going to have it really simplified because this is not a deep kernel kind of class. We have to look at how to practically do forensics, so we're going to look into some of the structures we need to know about in order to dig deeper, but we're not going to look too deep into these internal kernel structures of Linux, more or less the same way as we did with Windows structures. Especially with a focus on processes, how processes are represented, how we can extract processes. We're going to look at networking, all the internal structures and volatility tools for extracting networking information. And then we're going to look at the file systems, of course, extracting files from memory is really important. As I mentioned, volatility is our primary tool. I'm going to use many of the tools from volatility as examples to extract things and then discuss what we are actually extracting. All this can be found in the book, The Art of Memory Forensics, in the chapters 19 through 27. But more important, the volatility documentation contains a lot of the information, and that is open and free. So if you don't have the book, at least you need to read the volatility documentation. I think I put the URLs for the documentation up on the Windows lecture, and maybe I attach them here as well. So to acquire memory, dump the memory, We need to do some preparations, and we mentioned how you actually some kind of you taint the memory by going into a computer and having the computer dump the RAM itself because you're changing something. But you need to do something, and we discussed this during the Windows lecture. With Linux, if we have access to the system, which we normally need to do, unless you have this special hardware vulnerabilities or hardware implementation of dumping. You need access to the system. And then previously you had two devices. You had devmem and devkmem. Both of these devices gave access to the memory. Devmem gave access to the real memory, kmem to the virtual address space of the kernel. But due to the security risk of having these devices there all the time, even if they were protected like with root access only, it was deemed as too high security risk, and it was disabled by default because you don't really need them all the time, or those it just gives the attackers an easier way to access memory. So they are disabled from now in the later kernels. You have a tool called ptrace, which can get memory from running processes. It's only usable for one specific process, and you have and you can use this call it a tool, but a library within memfetch, for instance, use ptrace in order to dump memory for that running process. Not so usable if you're going to look at the entire memory, especially kernel memory. So you need some more modern tools. And fmem is a kernel driver, meaning that you inject the program into the Linux kernel, and then by default it has access to everything. So the fmem kernel creates the device. It can, and the real thing is that it actually can access all the memory. I didn't mention this, but devmem had only access to the low, almost one gigabyte of RAM, which was a problem for forensics with modern computers because they all have more than 1 gigabyte of RAM. Fmem have access to all the memory. You can check with the IOMEM, which is information about where things are mapped in memory, located in the proc file system. So if you do a grep for system RAM in the proc IOMEM file, you get where the system RAM is. And if you look at the file, which we can do here, hopefully. Just a second. It doesn't like. It really doesn't like being switched over when I'm in presentation mode. Okay, then we'll just have to do something. Well, you get a view of the memory areas. You can see most of it, of the memory areas. And what kind of data is in there? You can see here you have, in this memory area, you have the kernel code data and the BSS registries area. And then we need to go back there. So if you look at, I just took out all the system RAM in this. How much RAM do you think this computer with where the dump has been made has? It's kind of hard to see, but it's a 1 with 8 zeros, and it's an 8B, or it's 9 digits or hex digits in the last one as well. So it's approximately 8 with 8 zeros after it, hex. How much is is a 1 with 8 zeros after it? That's the border of 32-bit, right? So you have, if it's, this is the address of 4 gigabyte. So this is approximately 32 gigabytes, or almost 32, since it's not 8FFFF. So it's just a way of using information you can find by to extract more information, more relevant information. There's another tool as well called LIME, the Linux memory extractor. It can dump memory for Linux and Android devices. Same principle, uses a kernel module to extract memory through the kernel. And as with FMEM, you need to compile a module for your specific kernel, unless you can find that online. So for Lime, it actually supports three formats. It's the raw format, where it just dumps all the memory ranges after each other. It's padded, which is the same, but if it finds any gaps, it just pads them with zero, so it actually gets to be 32 gigs in our case. And you have an optimized file structure which just maps some header with information about where the RAM has been dumped from, addresses typically, and the data. Then the new header with a new set of with a new area, so you can see it's more of a. And actually, I think it's also compressing the data as well, so you can get the size really good down. So typically, when you use Lime, you insert the kernel module. After you've compiled it, you have this lime.ko, which is the kernel module, and you use insmod to insert the module into your current kernel. So you have to be logged into the system, of course, as root or with root access. And then you tell them where to dump the memory and the format of the memory to dump. And the module actually also has support for dumping over the network. So if you're sitting on another computer and want to dump there and not to the local file system of the compromised computer or the computer you're investigating, you can dump the memory over TCP to port 4444 with the format as well. And then on your local computer, you just connect to that port and you take all the information you get from that port and dump it to the file with Netcat. You're all familiar with Netcat? Yeah, I guess so. Please ask questions if there's anything. Another file system or information file system that's usable on a Linux computer is the procfs. Mounted on the proc gives access to different kind of kernel information from user space. So when you're a user, you can look at the proc file system. Let me see if we can find this here. You can see with the file system, it has a lot of files. Just a number, which is the process IDs. And if you want to look inside the process ID files, you can find information about those processes, those you have access to. So they're restricted in the same way as the processes are in the kernel itself. So you have to have access. If you have root access, you can access all the processes. And you have information here like CPU info. Which probably is easier to see if we just start using. So you can see information about the CPU and the current speed it's running at. You have mem info, which is a kind of easier way to see how much memory you have instead of calculating from the IOMEM area. And you have modules. You can look at all the mounted file systems. And you can look at which file systems are supported on this system, which is kind of interesting. Like you see here, all the different file systems supported by this kernel. Anybody been using Procd actively? You know it's there? Yeah, I guess you know it's there. You don't use it too much, but when you need information about the system, it's really easy to go there and look. And especially if you want to dig into things about the networking, things about one specific process, it's easy to go there and look. In addition, one thing that makes dumping memory really important in Linux is that instead of writing as previously, when memory was scarce, you had to save memory and you dumped things in memory to a disk in order to calculate something else in memory and do something else. Now you have so much more memory that it's been a shift of using RAM to be that swap area which we usually had on disk. So you compress information, and instead of writing it to a swap area, you compress it and put it in a separate section of RAM. And then it speeds up a lot. You don't have disk access, but you have RAM access with a little bit of compression. So it makes it really, really much faster. And with today's costs of memory, it's something that all Linux systems use. So if you have all this information in the swap area or the compressed swap area, you need to access it, and the only way you can do this is by dumping the memory. So of course, when you do use these tools which we mentioned and you dump memory, you can use volatility to decompress and make available the compressed swap, and you don't even have to know about it because volatility just extracts file information from that area if it finds it there. So if things are being written to disk, and instead of doing this all the time, it actually writes them to a part of the memory before dumping it to disk, then it's saved, and you can actually see all the last minute changes or last second changes in RAM instead of on disk. Is this made to last? What do you think? How will the development be? What counters this in a way? We've had some major development on the disk areas, right? SSDs. So SSD kind of counters this because SSDs are so much faster in I/O than the old disks were. So you're going to reach a place where RAM is so expensive and SSDs are getting so cheap that it's a cost trade-off then as it is now. But when RAM is so cheap as it is today and we're not using so much for running a system, then this will probably stay with us for quite some time. Okay, this I just included from the book. It says something about the borders of where things are stored. So it says user memory, and it says kernel memory. And this is the separation of where user memory and kernel memory normally is. Where's this border for a 32-bit system? Where is this? It's at 3 gigabytes. So it's 3 gigabyte, 1 gigabyte. At least with this version. You can change this in different kernels, but normally for a 32-bit. For a 64-bit, where's this border? Don't want to calculate, but how much is left?
Eight gigabytes.
double it. 16. 16, yes. Because you have half of the 32-bit range. So it's 16 gigabyte for this area, and 128 million terabytes, less and minus 16 gigabytes for user memory, possibly for user memory. So you have a huge area. So this is kind of a skewed representation, because user memory is always bigger than kernel memory in most systems. But anyway, you cannot scale this. But it, at least it says something about where the borders are, that the kernel memory is mapped to the top, which I mentioned before, and we'll see in the examples afterwards, and where and how the some of the parameters in the kernel are put in. We'll get back to some of this. So, if we want to use volatility on Linux, we need to use the correct profile. And why is that? Why must we select the right kernel version? Well, because structures change. If you have a change in some of the structures internally in the kernel, then volatility needs to know what the used structures are in that specific kernel on this specific system. So most of the kernels after 2.6.11 are supported. But if you think about how many Linux distributions do we have? Tens, hundreds maybe. How many subset versions do we have? How many launched versions, intermediate versions? There are so many that it becomes really hard to have everything located in one specific place. But volatility needs that specific profile of the running kernel. So how do you solve this? Well, luckily there are tools like this called the Linux Memory Grabber, which is a way of packaging or scripting how to build a volatility profile from a system. And as it says here, his goal was to make something as small to fit on a thumb drive. So you put the thumb drive in the computer, you run a script, and you get the profile out, and then you can do the forensics, because it does the analysis of how the kernel of that specific system is. That's the Linux Memory Grabber. If you need to do this more manually, you have to go inside the guest and do uname minus a, and you have to dump the system.map and a lot of more information. If you look at the LMG area, you can see everything that's being done. But for most of the common distributions, there are predefined profiles, because most of the big systems or the most used systems run one of these distributions. Anybody here actively using Linux every day? Which version or distribution do you use? Mint? Ubuntu. So everything based on Debian and Ubuntu, we'll go through here. CentOS, Fedora for more server-like. So you have this. I also mentioned it also have support for macOS kernels there as well, for those versions of macOS. You have the URL there. You can go and look into all the different, and you can download each of them if you want to. It looks like this. Oh, kind of tiny, but different kind of Ubuntu versions. 14.04, 14.04.3, server version, so on. So you can download, install, and then see. So you download the Ubuntu 16.04.1, the zip file, you put it in a file called profiles, and then you run --- plugin equals profiles, and you see which profiles can I list now. And you see all these windows are always present because they are compiled into or already injected into volatility. But you have this at the top there, which is due to just downloading the zip file and setting the directory to include it for plugins. Really simple to use if you can find the correct plugin. One problem is this is the last one for Ubuntu. I don't think, well, most servers and others may still be running 16.04 because it's a LTS version, but many computers, local computers and others use 17.04 or maybe 16.10. So it's not that often updated, so you might need to compile your own or build your own profile because it's just not there. I mentioned the link to building, creating a new profile found on volatility, which describes everything, how to do this. I also mentioned some of the tools or some of the installs you need in order to do this yourself. You need Subversion, you need a tool called Dwarf Dump, and you need development information, kernel devil and the Linux headers. And then you need to get volatility, and you have tools there to make this. So they actually compile and they make this. They make this zip, which contains two files, system map and a dump, or some binary information. If you look at your boot area, you can see you have your system map and version information there. That's one of the things that are included in addition to information compiled in with the tools. You can also do this by cross-compiling. Do you know what cross-compiling is? If not, it's just compiling for another system on your computer. It's like compiling for another version of the kernel. You need that kernel version here. You can also call cross-compiling for compiling for an ARM processor on an Intel processor, for instance. So you actually build the executable on a computer based on for another architecture. That's cross-compiling. So if you look in the, if you need to do this, if you're going to compile things outside of the target or outside of an installation equal to the target, you need to do cross-compiling, and then you can find information in the book and in general online. It's a kind of complex task, but easy when you have done this. Yeah, I mentioned how to use this. Oh, this is tiny. You mentioned the directory with the profiles. You mentioned the profile name. You can see there. This is the name we found here. As you can see, this has nothing to do with the name of the zip file. This is the profile you actually need to use. Profile name. And then you specify the file with the memory dump and what you want to do. And then you can see volatility starts dumping information. They discovered something I haven't seen before. This offset is a lot higher, you can see. This offset is just, it's at 96 bits. No, 96, I'm sorry, 48 bits. So it's probably the figure I had earlier is not correct for all versions, because this typically is not located at that area. This is a lot higher in memory. No, sorry, a lot lower in memory, going down.
Yeah. So you can still dump
Yeah, you can still dump memory because all of this is actually located somewhere in physical RAM, right? So it's just mapping up to this virtual RAM area, which is on the top of the 64-bit area. And what they've done here is they enhanced it from the figure I said on the top area because they wanted more space reserved for kernel and maybe other internal things. So they reserved the upper part for that. And everything below this, below FFFF80 is probably for the user area. But that's not the point here. The point here was you're listing the processes, and you can see all the processes running with the process ID and the parent process ID, kthread daemon. And of course, as with Windows, you can simplify this by using environment variables, volatility profile, name, plugins for the directory, and location for the actual file, which has to be on this specific format, file:// If you just have the path, it won't work. Like I said, if you get invalid profile, ABC selected, you have mistyped the profile name, or not giving correct path to plugins, or to the location. I could have added that. If you don't use this, you also get the same file, same error. Have anybody tried the memory forensics we went through on the last time? Yeah? No. Well, we can do this later today. Linux processes are represented by a structure in kernel memory called task struct. And it has a lot of different areas, kind of intuitive, but as you can see, there are a lot more. It's 6,784 bytes, and we're not even close listing the first ones here. So we have an entry called tasks, which is the link to all the active processes, which is always present. You have the memory mapped information. You have the process ID, group ID. You have some canary information. You know what canary information is? You have the operating systems, right? So for checking when you overwrite things on the stack. You have this information about the parent and the children, and information about the siblings. Siblings, you know the term? Yeah. Same parents. You have credentials. And then you have things like the name of the process, specifically, and threads. So it's quite an extensive list, and it contains all the information about the process. So when volatility finds this, it has a lot of information about the process in memory. And this has been used by... I can mention this as well. Oh, catching up here. A bit slow. If you use this volatility tool called VolShell, you get a prompt so you can access volatility directly. Then you can actually display all these structures inside volatility. You can see how the structures for this kernel version is, which is really helpful. So for here, if you want to go through the task struct, you can see how big the structure is, how big each entry is, the offset, and what kind of information is in each of the different areas. You can see there are ints and there are unsigned longs, and it's really good to have this information. You know what to read, how to parse it. And you can see here, you also have pointers, like pointers to other structures in the kernel. So if you want to do something actively, use VolShell. It's kind of light. Can I dim this somewhere? So the plugin Linux PS list lists all the processes as we've seen before with the process IDs and the start time of the processes. You can see here the date. And also the directory table base, offset for information to the kernel. We have also a process listing called PSOX, which is like PS-AUX, similar kind of information. You get the parameters on the command line as well. You can see what started, and you get the user ID and the group ID of the process running. So it's a useful tool to see all the parameters for one specific command, like the X server, and everything has been sent as parameters. Like with Windows, you have a tool called Linux PS Tree, where you can see or visualize what the parent processes are. Also with a process ID and the user ID of this. So you can see here, you have the X server with the login display manager, starting upstart, and upstart starts all this with GNOME session as one of the processes, starting all these GNOME applications on the desktop. So you can follow which application is starting which children application in an easy way. And you have this problem with the command line information. It's that malware can overwrite this because this structure is something that can be manipulated. The book shows how you can manipulate this by using tools and compile scripts. But you need to check multiple sources of information. Then you can eliminate this because they cannot delete this information from everywhere. So they have this this collection of tools here as well, PSXView, or Linux PSXView, which lists all the processes with where it actually found these processes. So if you can see here, I had some had a new kernel, so it didn't support everything. So that's why all of the entries in two of the columns are false. But if some of the information here was false, in between where some of the lines were true, some of the entries in one line were true and others were false, you could suspect that somebody had been trying to manipulate the information about the process. Because then it's hidden from a way of extracting the process list. So if one of these had been false, somebody had been trying to manipulate so that PS list could not find the process, and then you could become more suspicious. At least it gives you an idea of where to start looking. If you want to see the environment a process is running in, you can use PSEnv for a specific process, and you get all the environment variables set and used for that process. So this was the bash process, as you can see there, and these are the environment variables set before running bash. You can see down here you have the path to the home directory or the current directory, and you have the instance bin bash and the user information, and they have some X server information as well, or a lot of X server information. So you can look for things that have changed in the environment that could be an indication of something's wrong. Memory mapping. You can use the memmap tool to show how the virtual and physical addresses are mapped. So you see here, it uses goes through all the pages in a process. So I've chosen, I didn't choose the process, but it lists the systemd at top and the size here. You can see it's one page. And then how the area in the virtual memory is mapped to the physical memory. And this is just the complete list of everything I've mapped in the system. And just displayed the top 15 here, more or less. As you can see here, the physical is in the low part of, because these are real memory addresses, and the virtual ones can be a lot higher. And since this is a user, user land process, this is not within the FFF8 area in the beginning. You can also look at heap, stack, and shared libraries by using the proc map tools, and this is kind of unreadable. But then for one specific process, the bash process, you can see specific information here about the offset, the start and the end of the memory area, which flags have been set on this, and the inode of the file, of the information.
Flags are for the memory, right?
Flags are for the memory, yes. So these are memory flags. So this is if it's read-only memory or executable memory and writable memory. So we have the same kind of information there. Because as you might see from the other one, everything is a file in Linux. Everything is a file. So the data structure file is for everything. File descriptors are stored in kernel memory, and you have process file descriptors, you have file descriptors, you have device file descriptors. Everything is a file. So the data structure called file, which you can dump with a DT command, as I said, in vol shell, it will give you this information and some more, I guess. You have the path, you have the mode, you have the position to where the next read-write will happen, and you have the mapping information of where into the page cache this is. Everything is stored in kernel memory. And you can look at the open files for a specific process by using LSOF. Just as the LSOF tool of Linux gives you all the open files. If you use for one process, you get all the open files for the bash. And you can see here you have standard in, standard out, standard error, and you have the terminal input, I guess. I'm not sure which one this is, but you can find all the open files. Like you have for VMware's VM tools, you can see it has sockets open, it has pipes open, and it has a file open down there, two files open. So it just lists everything you have for one specific process. Okay, I think we're gonna need 15 minutes now, and we'll just continue after 15 minutes. So 9:15, we'll continue. Okay, and please remind me to turn on the microphone again. det ligger oppgaver, ja. Men ikke hvordan du skal løse dem. Så jeg tenkte, so just switch to English. There are descriptions of the lab online on Blackboard. It's called session 604 something, I think. Please let me know if you don't find it. It should be there. All the way at the bottom. And the lectures. It is on the lectures. So I'll go there. I've been passing around a USB drive for to avoid downloading everything. So when it's free, you can get a copy as well. The USB drive is down there. You can copy things. So if you're are online and do not have access to my USB drive, you will have to download it yourself, and you can find all the information about downloading in that description of the lab, so you can start doing this if you want to participate. All the information you need in order to perform the lab are in the memory forensics Windows part, or in the memory forensics Linux part, or the Mac part. But I didn't make a specific Mac lab task, but it's more or less like the Linux thing. Okay. We're closing up on 15 minutes past. Any questions from the first hour? I'm going to continue with more of the practical or usable sides of memory forensics, how to actually get some information out of the dumps when you have them. And not so much about the structures. Some information about the structures and way things are, but more about how to get the information out. So I mentioned the listing of the open files for programs like VMware Tools Daemon running, since this was a VMware dump. You can see all these typical open files for a daemon of this type. You can list all the threads of a process. So if a process has multiple threads, you can get information about this. So if you dump the information about the process called Pulse Audio, you will see it has threads. It has the main thread, which is the run, the executable itself. And also spawn the thread called sync and a thread called source. What do you think the sync and source actually are? Input and output, yes, because this is an audio program, then it's kind of convenient to have a thread for input running all the time and for output running all the time. So you can list them. And you add the thread IDs here. So you can actually go and search for more information in the thread structures if you need this. And there are so many structures, of course, but volatility gives you access to this and lists how the thread structure is by using vol shell. You can get information about the process state. When a process is swapped out of the active CPU, it saves the state, and then you can get the state of the registries for that process when it's swapped out. And since you're dumping memory, most of the processes not dumping memory are swapped out, so yeah, you get the information about the current state of the process at the dumping time. How could this be a problem for a tool running locally on the system versus a VMware dump?
Because
Well, the VMware dump is a snapshot of everything, right? So you know that everything has been frozen at the same time. So all the information here will be accurate because of the state. But if you're doing this live on the live system, then you have to run through everything. So if you are dumping things from memory, can you really guarantee that the information you downloaded about when things were swapped out of the CPU is consistent with when you actually got to the process and the state the process was in? Probably not. But so you might have an issue there. I don't know if any of the dumping tools take this into regard, but at least this gives you the state and it's accurate within VMware and dumps that are frozen. But if you access this information and you access the process area information in separate times, then you might have a problem here. You can extract the bash history. So there's an entry in the kernel called history entry, hist entry. And it is every entry in that of that data structure is a line in the bash history. So the bash history is what's been written when you have completed your bash shell. So you get the history of everything that's done. So if I run this volatility plugin called Linux Bash, it gives me the bash history of all the bash instances found in the memory. And for this system, it only found one bash process ID, and these are all the commands that had been run on this. You might remember from Windows that you had the similar kind of tool, but then you actually also got the output because that was connected to the command line. Here you just have the bash history, so you have no output. So this can explain things like these two lines. Where, if this is the home directory, where is the unzip being done? It could be, since you have download and have downloads, it could be in download / downloads, two subdirectories down. It could be in download if download / downloads does not exist because you don't know the output. It could be in downloads because if download doesn't exist, you don't see the output. And it could be in home if you don't have download or downloads.
Can you run with the microphone?
Yes, microphone is on. Thank you. So the unzip could be done in like many places. You don't know the exact location by reading this unless you go to the directory structure and then see what really exists. And we'll get back to how to dump the directory structure. But you got this. Since you have no output, you don't know if the command succeeded or not. Okay. The book makes kind of an issue if you have tools installed in your path and you're not using the correct tool, like the really early manipulating tools on system, if the system was compromised, was to replace things like LS or RM and then add the place where they really were in your path, like installed supplement or replacements for the tool LS in / temp, and then you added temp in the beginning of your path, and then it ran /temp/LS instead of bin/LS. So they have a tool for looking at which actual binary you ran from your bash shell. So you can see on the same image as the previous one, where you have the ls and cd and cd, which are bash commands, you have unzip, and I think LS is binls. CD is just for the bash. Binls, and you have user bin unzip. So it actually prints the path to which you were using. So if you have a compromised system, you can see if it's using the correct ones, or at least the correct path to the tools you have been using, or if it's replaced them. So it could say slash temp slash ls there, for instance. And then you can also extract path from the environment. So you just look at the environment, as we saw previously, PSN got you this huge list. I just extracted just the path here using a sed script. So you can see that if there has been a slash temp in the beginning of path there, it would have run slash temp slash any program before it found it later in the path. Linux networking, two main structures, Inet socket for information about levels on IP, structures on the IP level. And then you have SOC common for sockets. So you have for Inet, you have, first of all, you have the IPv4 parts, the destination port, source address, and the protocol type of the transport protocols. And then you have added a pointer to IPv6 info. So if you have IPv6, you have to find another structure. For sockets, you have destination address, source address, for socket family, for network connections over internet, it's AFINET. For, and the state, if it's a TCP connection, you also have the state, because the TCP connection has multiple states, as you know. So these are the structures to dig into and being used by, for instance, Netstat, listing all the active sessions or the listening programs. So you can see here, it has, well, first of all, it has file system sockets, but then it has network sockets as well. It's made to be more or less like the command netstat. You can see here listening, or this is the UDP on port 5353. You have TCP on port 631, which is the printer port. And these are on localhost. And you can also get the queues, because when you're having communications between between hosts, before the things are parsed and put into a process, things are held in kernel before they're actually being put in the right place. And then these queues can actually be dumped to disk by using command in volatility, use Linux packet queues. You need a directory for this, but then it dumps the raw packet data waiting to be processed by the kernel into a file. You can see here, dump it to the directory packet output. You can see it dumps the files receive with, I think this is the process ID of the process running them. Then you can find the information back here as well. You can see it's more or less same type of length on the information here. 1536, typically 1500 MTU.
Would you queue the empty if you say you didn't have a network connection at one point?
I guess so. I haven't tested, but you could test this. Just have a computer and see if you shut down all the network connections and update scripts and everything, and then dumped it. I think you should have an empty queue. So more networking, you get the ARP tables, which you know is the mapping from MAC addresses to IP addresses locally. You can get the interface configuration, so you can see you have your local host and you have your Ethernet information with the IP addresses and the MAC addresses of the interfaces. And the last part there, if things are in promiscuous mode or not, meaning promiscuous mode, as you know, meaning it actually dumps down everything that travels on the network, which is an indication of something might be wrong. If you're using promiscuous mode, you can list all the raw sockets to find anything using this. I have not been able to understand why this has been listed as a potential rogue process, but DS client is using UDP to set your IP address, so it might be it interacts in a way that that's suspicious. And on kernel versions up to 3.6 in Linux, you could get information about routing information from the kernel because it cached the routing table internally in the dump, so you can locate it. It does not work on versions higher than 3.6. You can see here it actually has all the interfaces with the destination IP addresses and where the gateways for the IP addresses are. Kind of useful. With having this information, what's available here that's not available normally in a dump? Interface, which interface is being used. Yeah, that's the thing. But the IP addresses of the hosts you actually visited or had interactions with will be there. So you can see even if it doesn't have any active connections today or just now, depending on how long the cache lasts, you can find where it has actually accessed information previously. I don't know what the standard cache time was, but it could be interesting. For hardware, you have the CPU info, which is more or less like the proc CPU info, just narrowed down quite a bit, extracting what CPUs there are on the processor or what kind of CPU. And you have access to the kernel debug buffer, the D message. You also have the D message command in Linux, which gives you almost exact same information, which is information about everything that happens and is being found during boot, which the kernel has to relate to in order to install the right drivers, get the right devices up and running, and so on. So it's useful information to explain your hardware. IOMEM, as we looked at earlier, you have the system RAM entries here to map that, and you also have information about where the kernel code, etc. is. So it's which physical addresses are reserved for which devices. You have video ROM, you have some other adapters. You have for PCI entries, PCI bus entries. It's not longer, no. I mentioned this briefly, but if you run Vol shell or Linux Vol shell for Linux, you get into a shell that gives you interaction with everything in that memory dump. So to get help, type HH. So use that command and see what happens. If you just use PS, you get the processes running. You can also display the structs, as I've been doing some examples from, extracting some of the information. The task struct by DT and then the name of the struct in the kernel. You get the task struct with the size and offset, name and type of every entry of the struct. And this is really good because this is relevant. This is just for that kernel and that memory dump. So the commands for Vol shell, 200 possibilities, it says. And just you can see you have a lot of information you can access through this. And I guess all the modules you can find in Vol shell are probably just collections of all this access given in Vol shell. This is more raw access, and then you make scripts or programs using this to get your high-level information like PS list and stuff. One really good feature of Vol shell is that you can change into the context of that process, meaning that if I go into the context of a process ID, I see the world, my memory, as how the process will look at that memory. So I have the context of the process in memory. So it actually implements the DTB offset information so that I can actually look at things from a process point of view, not from the dump point of view. You can also do this with structures. So if I map a structure into a specific memory area, I can look at how the values of the structure is with that memory area being used as the data for the structure. Meaning if I suspect this is a task struct area, then I map that area into a task struct. So I suspect this is a task struct area, starting there. And I can look at how the different entries are if that is a task struct area. So it outputs the information in a way that you can easily compare if this is a match or not, or at least if this is garbage or not the area at all. If you find pointers where there should be something else, or you find values like this, which are probably just values in the high memory area of this. I haven't calculated, but it looks like it's really high. So if you find this in the wrong place, you will probably understand this is not correct. Did you understand what I meant? You feel free to shake your heads, and it's okay.
Basically, it's just printing out the information.
It's printing out the structure information if the structure was located there. So, yeah. So, if I shifted with 8 bytes, for instance, it would take the memory address here and put a state. And then you get a completely different value as state, right? So it's easy to see if something's really off or not, because some of the areas, probably like ptrace and on CPU, are a low value. So if you shift wrong, many of those will not be correct. Or it could be a network information, network type of structure, and then everything would be wrong. But it's a way of confirming or reading values if you suspect something is mapped there memory. You can search for malware. You use something called Yara. So it has a tool called Yara Scan, which is in all platforms, where you add either rules in a file or you set the rules on command line. If you want to know more, you can check out VirusTotal has a description of Yara or on Wikipedia. But basically what it says is that you can make descriptions of malware families based on binary patterns. So you can, it's simplifying how to make regexp specific for this assignment type or this kind of classification. So if you want to classify malware, then this might help you. Yara is the language for this. And this is why they have implemented this. So rules can be a simple thing. It could be a string, or it could be a Yara type of regexp to search for. For instance, if it's just searching for a string, HTTPS, you can do this, and it will list the process and where it's been found in that process. And you can see HTTPS was found there. And the next one was at another place in the bash. In the bash program. So you have one address here and you have another address there. So it's found https://, multiple locations in that process. So that gives you a way of searching memory in a very good way. I don't know Yara myself, but I guess it's kind of similar to Unix regexp with some simplification, I guess. We can list kernel modules, like lsmod does in command line. You have some extra things. You have -p, which gives you parameters. You can see parameters sent when you start the module. So you see you have the different modules here, and you have rfcom, which has these call them command line parameters or settings when they start up. You can also print all the sections of the kernel modules with the addresses of where the sections are located. Since you can find the kernel modules and you have access to all the kernel area of the memory, you can dump the kernel modules, Linux mod dump, and the output directory. Then you can see if you're specific. I think I just dumped one here. Yeah. I don't know why. I think maybe it took too long, so I broke it off. But when you dump something, it dumps, and you can look in the output directory and find it there with the name and the address and .lkm for a kernel module. If you look at what kind of file it is, it will say that it's an ELF file, the Linux executable, 64-bit, relocatable. So the type is ELF, and you can use, for instance, IDA to analyze it later. You just dump all the modules. I think it was because it took quite a lot of time interrupted. And you get all the modules in that directory. You can check for rootkits because there are there are scripts going through all the system calls and then seeing which ones are specified in the correct way in sys modules only, or if it's other places and not there. So we have Linux check syscalls, which does this. It checks if a system call has been hooked. You know what it means to have a system call hooked? It means you redirect the system call to a place with your code. So instead of calling the function for open with the system, sysopen, you call your sysopen, which returns the information you need, but then you have intercepted and you can probably do something with that information or replace it. Sysread, syswrite. And there are lots of these syscalls that are really handy for an attacker to replace, because they give access to everything and it reveals what the, or you can hide information about the attacker's presence, especially if you try to list the processes or access information. You use these system calls to access information, and the attacker try to hide themselves by hooking these handler addresses to his own handlers, so it just disappears. You can check process credentials, because you use this structure, cred structure. I thought I displayed this. No, that's not the cred. Yeah. You can use this cred structure, which is the credentials of a process, to see how, or to see if somebody's trying to use another process's credential structure. Because when you're trying to inject malware, it's really hard to create a cred structure and inject this. So a lot of malware use existing processes' cred structures in order to get the right credentials. So if you have a cred structure defining root access or kernel root access, then it's easy for a process to point to that structure instead of opening his own cred structure and pointing to that. That's an extra task, and for some reason it's harder to do. You can use Linux check creds in order to check this for malplaced or reused cred structures. And I looked through all the images on from the book and had no success in finding anything in any of them. You can check for hooked interrupts. So you have interrupts happening on the process, and you can check if they're hooked or not, meaning you've replaced the address of where to go to when this interrupt occurs. And this is also a common way of taking over a system and hiding your presence. So if you do this, use this Linux check IDT, it will, I think in symbol it will say hooked instead of what it represents. And you can also check for key logging, separate tools for that. Check TTY and the keyboard notifiers, which works in the way that they check for if the TTY drivers are replaced or been hooked. And TTY drivers are the typical login terminal entries. And the keyboard notifiers goes through a list and checks if the callback is within the kernel itself. It's not in user land. So these are just scripts doing this, simplifying this for you, and you can see if something is not as it's supposed to be. Useful for malware suspicion. Now it's 10 to 10. I think we take 10 minutes break now, and we start on the Mac memory forensics, which is kind of short, and then we just continue with the lab afterwards. So we just take 10 minutes now and start up at 10 o'clock with Mac memory forensics, unless there were questions first. No, okay. Yeah, and the microphone's on, so memory images download, volatility download on the lab presentation, which we'll go through after the Mac presentation. And the Mac presentation will be after the rest of the Linux presentation, because I forgot I did split the Linux part in two files. And the other presentation is about files, so accessing files in volatility. So we'll look at that first. It's brief. I just needed to shorten the presentation. You know, dumping images into a presentation in LibreOffice is hard when you get to 40 or 50 pages, because it hugs so much memory that everything slows down. So I did have to cut out 15 slides and make a separate one. So we're going to do file systems, but there was a question first about credentials. So let's look at that first. I think it was about this slide. So the question, if I remember correctly, is why do processes reuse credentials from the credential structure? And the reason is in order to avoid doing an extra task of creating the credential structure and actually accessing that credential structure, it's easier. And for some reason, the creation of that extra structure is hard. It's a lot easier for rootkits to point to an existing credential structure than to create a new one. So by pointing to an existing one, they want to find one that has the correct credentials that they need, which is root user, and they just find that credential in the structure with the correct settings, and they point to that instead of creating their own new one with all the extras they need there.
Okay, so and the credential structure, what information is, why the process actually need the credential structure?
It tells you what your access rights are. Okay. In that process. So credentials are, what kind of rights do you have as a process in ordering, accessing everything else? And you want to find that credential structure that has the most access. And normally you want to point to the credential structure that process ID 1 points to. If you have the same one as the kernel's access, then you have what you need. So if you find two processes pointing to the same credential, then it's suspicious, because they're not supposed to do this. All the process rights, but I don't know the details. I'm sorry. Okay. So what I forgot was that we do have the file section of the Linux memory forensics part left. So one thing I discovered when running through the examples in the book was that there are changes, because the book is based on kernels quite up to 3.6, maybe 4.0 or something. But for new kernels, there have been some changes, and especially with file systems. So I didn't find examples of the structures, because they're not described there. And I've been Googling and trying to find what replaces, for instance, the VFS mount. It is there, but it contains just three or four entries. And the book says a VFS mount is the virtual file system information for entries, which is huge in the description. So just to make this clear, that there are issues with the book and the current system. But of course, for the examples, VFS mount exists and everything is good. So for looking at file systems, you have a tool called Linux mount, which just runs through the structures and find information about all the systems, the file systems that had been mounted on the memory dump. You can see here you have and the types, the devices and where it's mounted, and the types of file system. EXT4, you can see that tempfs, queues, and the access for the file system. You have enumerate files, which actually goes through and lists out every file it finds, meaning everything that it finds in memory, cached in memory, or a reference to in memory. And through this, you can list everything. But you also have a tool called find file, which if you specify a specific file, it will give you the inode number and the inode and pointer and the path through the file if it exists. And using this, you can actually find the inode pointer, and you can use it inside the same function with another parameter, dash I, and then output parameter, and you can get the password out. So I use this to find etc password, to dump etc password out, and to put it out on command line. So it's been used twice, one for finding and one for dumping. Kind of simple, but you need to know that the file exists. So for files, you need also, or what you can get from a file in addition is metadata, like size, MAC times, when it's modified, accessed, or changed. Permissions, owner, and the groups. I have a typo there. For files, there's an inode structure, the referencing everything. You have the inode number, which is unique for the system. You have the mode, which is the file type, meaning file type. It could be a file, it could be a directory, it could be a socket, it could be anything. Everything is a file. That's why you need a file type. You have permissions and size, IDs and size, user ID, group ID, and size. You have the MAC times. You have pointers to operation functions, which is how the Linux kernel works, quite simplified. These are pointers to functions which can operate on this memory structure. So you have pointers to functions that actually can work on this memory structure. Knows about this and knows how it's being used. And you have mapping, which is a pointer to another type of structure, which has both file area access. I'm not completely sure how that that pointer works. And you can see it's a huge structure, the inode structure. You can find all those I mentioned in between here, but you have so much more. It says 560 bytes, and we're not even close. Oh, I'm getting there. You can recover the entire file system from memory. Volatility has a tool going through, finding all files that actually exist or are referenced in memory, and then try to recreate the directory structure, write each file, and then try to maintain the metadata as best as it can, like owners, permissions, access times. One thing it cannot do is, of course, preserve inodes, because NTFS doesn't use inodes, one thing, if it's an NTFS, or if it's file system that doesn't support inodes, you have a problem. If it's on a file system that supports inodes, it could cause conflicts with what you actually have from before. So you cannot set the inodes to anything. So it doesn't preserve the inodes. But you have more or less everything else. So volatility uses the recover file system, and all it takes is an out directory. And I tried to do this. So here's how the book says. It doesn't say anything, just says how many files it recovered. My problem is that my script had a bug. It says type error, an integer is required. So I was unable to actually do this on that specific system. But as you can see here, you just access the file in the structure that's normal for a file system. I do this on the Mac on the Mac tools, so something was wrong. It could be that I had a kernel version that was too high, but anyway, didn't work. You can also dump files with more information, more regarding times and access times, in order to build timelines. And why do we need timelines? Well, it's important in forensics, of course. So if you want to do this, you can use something called Linux Dentry Cache, which builds a body file. A body is a file format that's used for timeline analysis. It's defined in the Sloth Kit. This URL, you can look at how the body file is. But basically, it's just a format describing information about the file and the access times and owner permissions, inode numbers. So everything should be preserved in order to build that timeline. A simplified way of doing this instead of dumping all the information. And it's persistence for all the different types of systems. Then you dump the body type, the body format for all file system, for Windows and for Mac and for Linux, anything. If you have this body file, you can see the files are in here. If you have this body file, you can use a program called MacTime, which doesn't have anything to do with Apple. It's just for Mac times. It's included in the Sloth Kit and in Kali. If you use Ubuntu, you could just install Sloth Kit and you have it locally. And that will take a body file and it will present a timeline from that. You can also recover file content from memory, because you saw the password file was file cover was content with content. If there's no content in the file length will be zero. But because Linux uses these page caches to save information when they read and write from disk, and the swap and the compressed swap, it also has page cache, as I said, the compressed swap, and a read-ahead cache. So if you're accessing things on disk, and the disk, well, normally this is because when the disk has spun up and is running, it's easier to read more information than just a little bit. So Linux automates this and reads ahead a bit. It reads the next part or something it suspects to be read next, and then caches this. to increase performance. And then you can access this information through the same functions you've seen before. So you have this page cache information located in the address space structure, which have this. We don't spend time. This is the structure. The important thing is that this is the page cache with the information about things happening, pointers to operations working on the structure, and like reading and writing. Like I mentioned before, you have pointers to functions working on the structures in order to connect them. This I mentioned in the previous one. Didn't I? I must have copied this and not deleted, because I did use this. Yeah. Linux mount is the same as mount and cat proc mounts, the file and the procfs, which gives you all the mounted file systems with the type and permissions. Yeah, I used this because I demonstrated this. I just forgot to cut it out again. Yep, been through. So we're going to go over to Mac file forensics, or memory forensics. Any questions on the file area?
Slides?
Pardon?
No questions about what type of questions did you think of?
With?
If I would ask questions.
Yeah, yeah. Anything. Yeah, slides or not?
You had the possibility to recover the files, the file content, but I guess that is only true if, say, you have data that is not complete, you have partial data. You can't use it for carving, I guess.
If you have partial data of the files? Dump file system, or
yeah, maybe.
Or the even, well, I think I know what you're asking. If you're only reading ahead parts of a file's information,
yeah.
I'm not sure if that is stored or if the page cache only reads in and caches entire parts, because I haven't seen any partial files in the dumps being made at all. So I think at least the extraction only extracts full files. But if the information contained in the dump contained partial, I haven't seen any tools in Volatility that carves them or tries to carve them. So I don't know if it exists. But if it does read the head and has information that that could be useful in that kind of reconstruction, I think you have to write the tools yourself, or at least Google for others. Okay, so briefly on Mac memory forensics, some acquisition and a lot more focus, or even same focus, on using Volatility on hardware, process, files, networking, and locating rootkits. Just resource information, the book chapters. This is a blog which has been found highly interesting for Mac forensics. It's Mac forensics, as you can see, 4 and 6. Blog. Go there and look for how to do forensics on Mac OS X. Using command reference and where you can find the process, the profiles. And you have downloading the releases as well, as you got from the USB. So some, I call them specialties, but some things that aren't supported on other systems. You have support for running 64-bit software on 32-bit architecture, which makes things kind of different for handling and looking in dumps. You had early ASLR for the kernels, So functions and the global variables are at different addresses after reboot. So all these static addresses that you can find in the system map on Linux are not static and they're not the same always. So in order for using this, you need a slide to find this ASLR shift when operating on Mac dumps. So you have to, you can use a tool called Mac find ASLR shift to give offset and then implement this shift as a parameter to your commands to avoid this recalculation. But for, on my computer, this took no time at all, so it wasn't necessary to do this. And it actually, well, you can see here, I tried to exemplify what you can do. You find this large shift, the shift value, and you set this shift value, and then you can use this in your carving. In your forensics. So about memory acquisition, well, VMware is kind of a non-issue since you're not allowed to run Mac OS in VMware. Many people do, but you're not allowed to do it. So you need, of course, to be dumping memory from the operating system itself. So it's the same thing as before. You could be tainting, you could do something. And the FireWire memory dump originated from the Mac, so you have that, but only for the low memory part. And previously also had DevMem and DevKMem, but when when Apple made the switch to Intel hardware, they discarded all the access to DevMem and DevKMem, as Linux has done. So you need to use tools. And I said there are three tools available, but I'm mentioning two. Mendiant, they have something called Memrise, or Mac Memrise, which they say just helps you doing everything you need. It has ASLR support, it dumps everything, all load the kernel extensions. So this is one of the recommended tools. And you have the other one, OSX PMEM, which you can find here on still on code.google.com. It's an open source tool which has a user mode acquisition tool and a kernel extension, so you need to know the kernel as well, the real one. So it makes a device to get all physical memory and then dumps it to the user mode tool. There was a third one mentioned in the book, which I have found no references to anywhere. So they said three, I found two, and the third one I think has been decommissioned or has been taken into the company and made proprietary because it's not available at all. To fetch volatility profiles, Mac OS is a lot simpler than Linux. You don't have that many distributions, you don't have that many versions and many alternatives. So most or almost all versions can be found in the downloads on the Volatility Foundation on GitHub up to 10.12. Is there a later version now, or is it just being expected? No, I think, well, I think 10.12 is the latest. I'm not a Mac user. Yeah. Of course, you have a way of building your own profiles because the Volatility Foundation have these tools with them. Mac create all profiles, and then you can do this on the Mac. It's supposed to be easy. I've never done this, but the description of how to do this is in the Art of Memory Forensics book. So the best thing about going through this now is that things with macOS is quite similar to Linux because they have their Unix foundations in common. The BSD based origin, and they support POSIX, meaning they have a lot of related functionality, even if they have different kind of structures and structure names. So it's kind of similar, and it's easy to build the same kind of tools on Linux and Mac. And you can also find this when you look at the tools and the tools name, the volatility Linux underscore something, it's almost always the same as the Mac underscore, the same name. But there are some differences, and probably when they have extra parameters and some things you can dig on Mac that you cannot on Linux and vice versa, you have different names, but many of them are the same. So for hardware, you have machine info, which gives you information about the software running, number of CPUs, physical and logically, memory size. And you can also see you have the Mac version here. So this is done on, I think all these volatility dumps are done on the sample name one on the memory stick you just received. So the book has samples 1 through 4 or something. This is done on sample 1 if you want to test this. Mac has two structures for processes. It has a proc, which has a pointer to a list, a global list of processes. And you have the same as you see here. You have the process ID, the user ID running the process, the group ID. You have a parent pointer. You have pointers to the sibling and a list of siblings and list of children. You have the pointer to the file descriptor of the process. And you have the names in both ASCII and Unicode. And you have a lot more. So if you go the same thing, you go into Mac vol shell and you dump the structure with DT, you get the description of the structures. And inherited from BSD, it has something called task, which maps or is a description of the mapping for tasks, threads, and BSD info, and some other things. So it can use both these structures maintained internally in the macOS. You have PS list, more or less the same. You see offset, you see name of process, process ID, user group, parent ID, what kind of executable, 64-bit, and start time, and the DTB offset per process. You have a task list, which is kind of similar. It just runs through another structure. I guess it uses the task structure, and you get it just a different ordering, more or less the same information. I would suspect you get all the same information, but different ordering. You see this starts with process 0. It's sorted by process ID. This is, well, reversed by process ID for some reason. You have other kind of process listing. You have something called pgroup hash table by enumerates by walking something called the group hash table. And you have something called the PID hash table, which you can also walk through. And all of this can be used in order to give a complete list of the processes. And you have the Mac version of PSAUX. Same as on Linux, except here you also have the information about 32 or 64-bit. Process ID, name, stack pointer, length. Oh, number of arguments. That's nice. Okay. Something specific for Mac, you have something called dead procs, which will print out all the terminated processes or dead processes. This information can be useful. And here you have some carving to be done, because some of this could be overwritten. So when you use this, you get entries like this, where you have some garbage in between. You actually have a process name or process name here that's interpreted as something weird. And you can see the rest of the processes are not good. But you can see the first six are probably okay. And you can see the start time of the process and information about the process. So it finds information about processes that has recently died before this information is overwritten. And this gives you useful information to see somebody just ran bash, somebody launched something. I don't know what launchd actually does, but it's probably a helper application to start processes, I guess. And WebKit, that's a part of most applications, right? PSX View does, as with the other PSX views on Windows and Linux, it combines information from different ways of finding the processes. And you look for lines that are special or different than all the others. If somebody's trying to hide processes, they will try to hide them in specific places. You could try like this. It's kind of strange, but since this is the main process, the kernel task, the kernel itself, it's not so strange that that's the only one false. But if any of these had one false entry, that's not in any of the others, somebody has been trying to hide the process. So it tries to use pslist, it uses this group hash, PID hash, these different ways of accessing, as I mentioned. And you have process trees here as well. Get the hierarchies. Same way as with Windows and Linux. You also get the bash history with Mac bash. Just as Linux bash, you have Mac PSN to see the environment with the process. This is the bash process, the environment for the bash process. You get the information, and you can see it's different than for the Ubuntu version. You don't have all the X configurations and like that. You have the hist file. You have some of the same information, but not even close to the other specific ones from Linux. You can list sessions, so you enumerate sessions from the sessions hash table, linking processes to usernames. So each username is in one session. So you have the process ID and the login name. So I guess these are the users running, the names of the users. It's simplifying. You have LSOF for listing open files, which will give you everything that is open on the running or the snapshot of the kernel. You have Mac mount, give you the file systems mounted. And you have the same kind of tool. You can list files instead of dumping everything. You can list them first. So you use Mac list files and you send everything to a text file in order to search it later, because it really dumps everything, so everything it knows about. And then you can look through and see if there's something interesting. If you found some GIF file or found something suspicious, you can go through and you can try to recover this. And you can use recover file system. And it will dump everything, just as with Linux. It will dump everything to this subdirectory. If you have something that's not cached but referenced in some way, it will be zero in length, so it will know about this. But everything that's more than 1 byte or more than 0 bytes will be a file or a directory. So you can use find in order to find files that are of specific length. Like this example, if you use dash size plus 1c, meaning 1 character or more, 1 byte or more, and it's a file, then it will print everything that's actually a file with size. And then if you're searching for text files, you add the iname .txt. So if you want to search all extracted files and the users, you use just size plus 1c type f, and you will get all the files that actually have size under user. So you extract everything, or you find everything in an easy way. And you can go and see if something suspicious and look at the contents of these files. Networking, kind of similar to Linux. You have ifconfig, setting all the interfaces. Also see here, what you didn't see on the Linux one, you have IPv6 addresses on ifconfig. You have the ARP table, useful. And you have the MAC route, which is the routing table of the version running kernel. So you can see here all the local hosts with IP addresses. No, not the local ones. It actually caches the entries here as well. So this is, I didn't notice this, but this is on another IP address range. This is externally, so it actually caches information. So we can get the cached routing information from MacRoute. It could be that this is an old kernel on Mac, so and it still doesn't work on the new ones, but it's on the example, sample one. You also have netstat, same thing. You have Unix sockets, you have UDP information, TCP information, and connections. I think I didn't list any connections here, but you have listening sockets here on TCP for processes, and you have UDP connections or sockets open. You can list all the kernel modules, lsmod. And you have also tools for checking for rootkits. So you have system calls. You check the handlers of a system control, I guess. I'm not a Mac user, I'm sorry. So this script will give you an OK or an unknown for all these handlers. Some are different, you can see here. The address is 0, but it still says OK, so it's probably something it knows about. So if the handler is off or something suspicious, it will say unknown for status. And it also will check for hooking. It looks at the system call table or something called the trap table. So this is the explanation from the book. So if they overwrite the pointers, they take control over the data returned and have capability of masking themselves, right? So they have check syscalls, more or less the same. Status will be hooked if something suspicious found. It also has check trap table, same thing. Symbol will be hooked if found something. I went through all the samples from the book, and none of them had the trigger on this. So I was unable to exemplify this, but at least it looks for things in a specific way, which indicates that something's wrong with the system. And it has a function called MacNotifiers, which detects hooks in the IO kit, Like if you have a keylogger, it injects in the IO kit, and then it will be overwritten, so it takes over your keyboard, the passing of things from your keyboard into your system, and that in things like this will be noted by this notifier script. So just a quick run through of this kind of similar tools that Mac has, very much the same as with Linux, which are also kind of the same as with Windows. So volatility is more or less like an overbuild, giving some kind of the same tools to examine for problems in any operating system. So I think we just start on going through the first part of the lab, just getting there, and then we just continue working on the lab for as long as you want to be working on the lab. Then at 12 o'clock, if we are finished, we're finished. We can do questions about the exam. We can do questions not the next time, but at a specific hour later, after the next lecture, if you want to do this. But let's continue with the lab now and lab questions. If you have questions, I will still be here and we can talk about them. And I will go through the first part of the lab after you have been trying for solving that, the first part, because you need the first part in order to do the second and the third. So I want to make sure that everybody gets the first part set up correctly before leaving it to yourself. So on to the lab. Let's see. This was, yes. So, starting with the lab, as I mentioned for somebody already, if you have tested Memory Friend 6 or you have volatility up and running on your computer, that's great because then you don't need to do so much preparation. If you don't, you need to set up volatility. And if you don't want to run volatility on your own computer, you want to run it in VMware, you need to set up an environment in VMware that you can use. And I recommend using Ubuntu. So if you use Ubuntu, you have to download and set up VMware first before you can start the lab. It's recommended, if you're using VMware, that you have at least 25 gigabytes of the on the disk for Ubuntu. I recommend you have even more. If you have you're running it on your computer, you need at least 16 gigabytes because you need at least 4 for the, actually it should be 17, I think, 4 for the file itself, a memory dump file, and unpacked it takes like 12 or 13, so you need a lot of space to get all the memory dumps on your computer. Yeah, I updated the 17 here, yeah. You can find volatility at this address. You just download volatility standalone for your operating system. For Ubuntu, it's Linux x64. And you unzip it, and you get these files. Sometimes volatility needs stuff installed, but if you use this compressed version, which is all in one, you don't need this on Linux and Windows, and I guess not on Mac either. It just works on Mac as well. Yeah, great. So if you just rename the executable or copy it to a place, you use it like I've done in the examples. I use .vol, .vol for the file. So I just renamed it. And then test and confirm that it actually runs. So you just run it. If you use --help --v, you get all the commands that are possible on all architectures. And I just grep for YaraScan because I know that's on all architectures. So you get YaraScan, Linux YaraScan, and Mac YaraScan is a part of that huge list. And you know you have access to everything. At least it starts and it works enough. So you haven't configured, it just works. In order to analyze something, you need, like you said, you need the profile. So we just have to download the memory images first, and they can be found on the page of the book. Oh. There we go. Click on the presentation, see if it works, where it actually sends me. Yeah, you end up on the book there. So this is the page, and you can see downloads down here, all memory images. Jumped on, yeah. So when you downloaded and unzipped, unpacked into some area, I just used the lab area, you have Linux and a Mac directory, and it totally should be around seven gigabytes. Yeah, seven gigabytes. And the downloads and the original. So it does need some space. So we'll do some Windows on Linux, and I was hoping to do some Mac forensics, but after thinking about things, and it's so similar to Linux that it's easier to look at the examples or try to perform them yourself. So you can test the same things with the Mac as with Linux. So what you need to do to make this simple, you need to use plugins and the file location and the profiles in the correct way. And if you use the environment, it's highly recommended. It makes things a lot easier. We're going to use Lab 1 to actually try to find out how to do this. So find the profile names. This is Lab 1. The profile names for the downloaded memory dumps, and we're going to look at the first examples of Windows memory and the first example of Linux. So, how do you actually get the right settings for those images, Linux, Windows, and Mac? So, if you start with trying to do this on Linux, it's the same thing as I did in the beginning of the lecture today. And then on Windows, it's the same thing as on the beginning of the Windows Forensics lecture. You need to find which version of Windows this is. And then you need to set the right parameters. So this is the first part of the lab. After today's lecture, I will give a solution to the first part of the lab. And then you can do the second and third part yourself without anything else, because the first part just solves the setup. The other parts are for more diving into and using the commands of volatility. So I think we're just going to start there with the lab. If you have questions, feel free to ask them. If there are questions for everybody to hear, I'll go up here and use the microphone, but whenever you're ready, start testing and start asking questions. Okay? No questions now? Okay. I don't think anyone, well, is somebody using a virtual machine? I'm not using it. Somebody is. So, yeah, good. So, but it's not necessary. If you trust the volatility scripts, then you're good. If you don't trust the volatility script, then you should run it in a virtual machine. But volatility is being used by hundreds of forensics analysts around the world. I think if something was wrong, I think it should have been discovered at least, but I don't guarantee anything. Did you get the files? You can, I have them here if you don't want to download. Okay. So has anybody found the answers for how to access all the profiles? Who found the Linux and Mac profiles and the names? Some found them. Okay. Did anybody find the Windows version? I guess not. So we're just going to go through how to set up this correctly. So the memory dumps for Linux and for Mac, they were assisted with a zip file, which is the plugins for reading them. And in order to actually see the name, you need to include the area where the zip file is located into the plugins command. So if you do it with setting the environment, you use volatility plugins like this, and current path, and the Linux area, for instance. So when you do this, it will include everything of zip files that is in volatility format, and include and list the profiles. So when you do this and you use vol info afterwards, you will see all the profiles, and you see all the Windows profiles will just fall out there. But on top you have this Linux book x64. So if you set this then to Linux, use volatility with just info, you get the same information as if you use vol dash dash plugins equals the current path to Linux or just Linux, and then run this and you get the name there. And then you have to set this name in order to use the profile. So for Mac, the same, you set the plugins environment to Mac directory, list the profiles, and you get Mac Mavericks 1093 AMD x64, which is the name of the profile. So for Windows, it's kind of different because all the Windows profiles are built into volatility. So we need to get some information about this. And from the beginning of the Windows memory forensics lecture, we used a tool called image info. And the image info gives us an estimate of what it thinks it is. It runs through looking for this KGBG entry, and based on this, it guesses or makes the best guess and best effort of what kind of Windows this is. And it says suggested profiles, Windows XP Service Pack 2, x86, Windows XP Service Pack 3, x86. And when you run this without having set any profiles by default, it will run as a Windows XP Service Pack 2, x86. This is like the standard version if you don't specify anything. So in order to try to find out if it's Service Pack 2 or Service Pack 3, we can use a tool called KGBG scan. So if you just use KGBG scan, you have volatility with the dump here. You try with the profile called Service Pack 2, the one first only found, KGBG scan, and I pipe all the output to a text file. That's just for simplicity. You can list them up and you can see what they say and how good the match is. But if I take Service Pack 2 and Service Pack 3 profiles and send them to a text file, I can see the differences if it finds something. What is significant is if it actually finds matches. Oh, this was image info. That it finds matches and finds threads, finds processes, and all this information is in that that output. But the only differences here between those two files are the service pack 2 and service pack 3 headlines. So it will probably be okay to use both profiles because they look at the memory in the same way. So this dump would work with both these profiles. So we just choose one of them. And I thought I had, I will just take a minute and set up how the environments should be on a single page. So we have that as a reference as well for using for the last ones. But when you have the profile names, that's where you use the volatility profile environment settings. You have location, which is the bin file, and you have the plugins environment to the directory with the plugin. So then you can set all three. I will summarize that on a single page now and load that up so you can see. Yes?
Okay, I just want to ask if the solution slides will be uploaded to the
platform. Yes, I will make that page and add that and export a version with the solution on lab 1 so that you have that for the rest of the labs, because you need to have it configured correctly in order to do the rest. So I'll do that. So in like five minutes, I will have done this and export and upload the file. Any other questions first? Did you understand what I did with finding the names? So I just used the downloaded profiles for Mac and Linux. But for Windows, you need to use the tools in order to find what images they are. And then you can extract the information and see if it matches. Okay, so there are the solutions which makes things work. If you use these as environment variables, so just copy and paste those three lines for each of the different samples you're going to use, and change the name of the samples, so you're using the correct one that you expect to be using. And remember that if you write this, these are back apostrophe, so this actually is executing the command in line there. So it's the path to Windows catalog where the .zip file is. And the same goes for this. That's the path. So the same as using the pwd command. So if you just copy and paste, it's okay. But if you type it, you have to type it with that apostrophe, not the other way around, because then it doesn't execute. You can see it will say /home/user/wherever-you-are/windows. You can use full path as well, but this will do it. And then by having this set, you should be able to run volatility on all these samples, on the Windows sample, on the Mac sample, and on the Linux sample. Okay? Yes?
I had a question regarding the Windows sample. How did you determine to use the service factory profile? Because the run K debug scan, it suggests both.
Yes, it suggests both. And when I did the KGBG scan, it didn't have any differences. So since there are no differences, you just select one, and I just selected number 3. So it's no other idea of doing Y, and just it found the equal amount of process, the equal amount of threads and files and everything. So I didn't just selected one by random. A hint for? A hint on something's wrong? Okay, look at process ID and parent process ID and children process ID and see if you can find something that doesn't, that's kind of unusual or unintuitive. if something's missing or something's not easily understood, so just ask, and I'll put it out on Blackboard. But for just running through one and two, finid. Find explorer access process ID, parent and children processes, and what seems to be wrong. So to summarize, if you use PS3 or Linux PS3, then you find the process ID to be 274, parent ID to be 244, and the children ID to be 548, 796, 984, and 556. What I mean by interesting is that the child process of 1796 has an ID of 244, which is the same as the parent ID of the process itself. So it seems like what you have started through Explorer actually has the same ID as the parent of Explorer itself. So it seems like to being a loop. But I don't know why this is, but my thoughts is that this might be that the MDD is the service doing the memory dump. So this is a tool with kernel access, and for some reason it has been given or taken or submitted or set up as that ID because of how it's injected or how it's accessing memory. But the MDD process, I just tried to find out what that does. What that was is probably the dumping process itself, and that's why the IDs are kind of strange here, at least getting that number. Number two, which was dump the executable disk, command.exe, and see what file type Linux thinks this is. So for dumping, you use proc dump. And then dump here, you have created that directory, so it dumps everything. So you just dump all the executables there. Command.exe gets 1796.exe. And then you just run file on this, directory name, executable 1796.exe, and you see that it's an PE32 executable console application for Windows. So all you get from proc dump is all the executables you can find in memory. So you're cheating. You're just not dumping. You're not jumping just the one, but you're dumping everything and then selecting the one you want. So dumping DLLs should be easy with the tools if you go through the presentation from Windows Forensics. And a hint for number four is that this is not Vista or later, so this is XP, so it's not the same as the examples in the presentation you have to use. I mentioned what you have to use, but I didn't use an example in my presentations because it's different from XP and to the later versions of Windows, how you log crashes. So you need to look at the event logs in some way. Okay. And for Linux, you have to change the settings to Linux sample, and then these are kind of straightforward with the tools we've been going through today. It should be kind of easy. But before I will let this presentation be as it is, and I will submit a solution before the next lecture in 14 days. But I think it's good that you have something to work on without the solution first, because it actually makes you dig a bit, and then you will get the solution on how you can solve these 9 questions then maybe next weekend. So any questions about the lab or today's lecture? Okay, which lab? The lab in 2 weeks? The Jeff Ham lab?
No, this lab.
This lab, okay.
Second one. I've used crash info, tried to use it, but I got errors. I'm not sure why I got it.
When you try to look at the event logs?
Yeah.
And you used the right tools, because you have two ways of looking at event logs, one for XP and one for the neurons.
EVT logs.
EVT logs, and you got a crash.
No, I did a crash info, so I'm wondering what's if it's intended to do that or not.
I don't know. But but just to summarize then, in 2 weeks there will be a lecture on malware or static binary analysis and some introduction to dynamic binary analysis by Geir Ola. And the same week there will be the second lab week with Jeff, which will be an hour earlier, I think, but we'll update this on Blackboard, the exact hours and schedule, so you're certain. But it will be from Monday to Thursday, and a bit earlier on Thursday, but and I think an hour earlier the other days as well. And we'll have a session after that for just for questions in front of the exam, because it's kind of long. I think the exam is kind of late, June 14th or something. So we have some time to get an hour or two where we can have some questions. If we cannot do it live here, we'll do it online, or at least